This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. These days, a kind of conventional wisdom dictates what students and their parents expect from any given college major. Practical majors with real-world applications like engineering and business are assumed to be lucrative, while majors like history or philosophy are seen as less likely to leave you at graduation with an immediate job offer. But while many of these stereotypes do play out, a new report from the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce shows not as much as you might think. Furthermore, even those recent grads from fields of study with the highest levels of unemployment still do better than their peers with only a high school diploma. Today in The Exchange, the dollars and cents of a college degree. Let's hear from you. How does talk of so-called useless degrees hit your ears? How much do you think that employment and salary should guide what someone chooses to study? A lot or a little? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. With us for the hour is Anthony Carnevale. He's director of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, author of that report I mentioned, The Economic Value of College Majors. You can find the report on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Anthony Carnevale, welcome back to The Exchange. It's good to have you.
Nice to be here.
Well, lots of angst, Anthony, as I'm sure you know, among parents and young adults about what to major in if they want to get a decent job when they graduate. And some parents or other advisors are encouraging their kids not to get so-called useless degrees. Is there any such thing as a useless degree, Anthony?
In the end, there isn't really any such thing. First of all, everybody needs to remember that the purpose of a college education is to help you live more fully in your time, but a word to the wise, you can't live fully in your time if you're living under a bridge or if you're lucky in your parents' basement. So you need to pay attention to the economic returns to your degree. But in the end, if you don't do what interests you and suits your values, you won't be very good at it either. So it's a complicated decision.
It is complicated. How much would you personally, Anthony, guide a young person in terms of how much value to put on these measures of economic value? You're kind of touching on it, so it's interesting.
I think in the end, the value is clear. That is, you should follow your dreams, but keep your eye on the economic value of what you're doing and what kind of career pathway it will provide for you. Because remember that when you graduate from college, what you've taken in college will influence what you do after breakfast for the next 45 years. So it's a big decision. If you really love something, you have to figure a way to do it for a living so you can do it all the time. So being mindful of career, I think, is crucial.
Do you think that young people today are being guided a little too much towards this don't get a useless degree, get something that'll get you a good job, you don't want to be unemployed, look at the Great Recession?
I think there's a lot of angst but no information. The colleges in the United States, we really have no tracking system. One is gradually being built. When students enroll in college, the college really doesn't know what the career prospects are for different degrees. There's anecdotal information, and sure, your professor in history has a sense of what happened to the previous history majors, but there's no data. Interestingly, in the last 10 years, the federal government has dropped almost $750 million on the states to help them build those information systems, and we're just at the point where we're beginning to use them. But for the most part, students and institutions really don't know what the economic value of their programs are.
So that's where you come in, right, Anthony? And you've got this huge study looking at unemployment rates and salaries, right, of all kinds of different degrees. Just give us a sense of the scope of what you guys have done.
Well, it is a census-based analysis. That is, it's a sampling that includes 35 to 40 million Americans. The data has only been available since 2011, and it's only been available twice. This is the second time round for us, but it is a fairly comprehensive study of the value of 137 college majors, which we then break down into 11 areas. So, for instance, there are 9 or 10 majors in business, but they have very different outcomes. If you major in hospitality, which is a business major, you won't do very well. If you major in business economics or accounting and finance, you'll do quite well.
Is the assumption that you make, again, using especially the unemployment rates or employment rates for these various fields, is the assumption that you're working under, Anthony, that if a graduate of a certain degree is working, he or she is working in that field? Because, for example, if I have a degree in music but I'm working at Dunkin' Donuts, you know, does that still count in your study as employment, even though it's pretty far from what I went to school for?
Oh, yes. In the end, we have 3 standards we use. One is, do you get a job? And is the job a steady job? That is, how many economic quarters are you working? And secondly, how much do you make? Is your earnings relevant to the cost of your education? Does it make it worth it? And 3, are you working in field? And we know that if you're working in field, you'll make 30 to 40% more than people who aren't.
So that example I gave, the music major working at Dunkin' Donuts, that wouldn't count as employment in your...
Well, it would count as employment. What we'd see there is that there's... we'd see the employment rate, which will be lower than a business major. We'd see the wage rate, which would be lower than a lot of majors and in this particular case. And we would see that the person is not working in field, and that would explain some of the disadvantages in that particular field of study.
So we're not really saying there's useless degrees, but you guys do seem to say in this study, Anthony, that some degrees are more useful than others. Not all degrees are created equal, certainly. Which degrees did you find really came out on the top in terms of employment and salary?
Well, the one that comes out on the top, which is not much use in New England, is petroleum engineering. And that one's off the scale over the last 7 years or so. It's really anywhere from 130 to 150 grand a year for early on in your career. But in general, that reflects the fact that anything in engineering, mathematics, the sciences, chemistry, physics, and anything in computer science especially, are high paying and very high concentrations of people working in their field, and very high concentrations of people who move from their field into managerial positions very rapidly. And then you get healthcare and business, which are also high earners, high employment. And then there are majors like education, where the employment is very high. That is, your chance at a job is very good, and your chance at working in field is very good, but you don't make any money.
The employment rates are interesting, though. I did find that useful. So maybe people aren't making tons and tons of money, but they're getting jobs. That's good, right?
Yes, that's the marker people sometimes forget. That is the first trick in the hat trick to have a successful career is get a job. The second one is make some money. And the third is, if possible, work in your field, because then the learning translates directly into earnings and the learning you do in the job. So if you study engineering, you become an engineer. Your education never really stops in engineering. It just keeps going.
So engineering, business, education, healthcare, those are some of the fields with the lowest levels of unemployment. What degrees, Anthony, tend to leave graduates in a tougher position when it comes to finding a job?
Well, it all depends on the economic cycle. So since 2007, since the beginning of this recession, and notably for the graduates in 2007 and 2008 was the worst. The fields that you'd expect, the humanities and liberal arts and more general degrees, really have not done well. On the other hand, because of the specific nature of this recession and recovery. It began in finance, and whatever begins in finance on Wall Street hurts construction because there's no capital to build, and so housing, construction, and those sorts of industries went down hard. So that meant if you were a civil engineer, things were not so good. If you're a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, you'd do much better. So, and architects have done very badly in the recession. So sometimes recessions or downturns have very specific origins, which will hurt even the high-wage workers in those industries. So you have to know, and sometimes it's hard to know before it suddenly falls on you, that how economic circumstances are affecting your particular major. So in the 70s and 80s, whenever NASA and the Defense Department pulled back, engineers suddenly were out of work, but eventually they would always come back within 2 to 3 years.
Well, related to that point you just made, Anthony, here's an email from Jerry who says, when I taught at the university level, students would ask me what field they should go into to make the most money. I told them that the most lucrative jobs today could be the least in a few years. She says there's no way to predict. Just look at the recent downsizing. Jerry says, I also suggested that they should major in what they have a passion for, because worse than being out of a job is being out of a job that they hate. She concludes by saying one can always go back to school or get more training if there's a change of heart. Jerry, thanks for the email. What do you think, Anthony? Kind of relates to what you were saying earlier.
Well, when you think in terms of an optimal career these days and the recent data, it's a career in which between 25 and 35 you change jobs 5 times, and then you change jobs once every 5 years after that. That wasn't true 30 years ago. You stayed in a job to advance, but now you got to move. So the trick here is it is true that things will change over time, but you have to get the first job before you get the fifth job, and the first job will determine the pathway you're on and determine the second, third, fourth, and fifth. So there is a. It is true that things change in the economy very rapidly, but different fields give you a different starting point. That's the way to think of it. And there is more stability than people often think. That is the. We know there's going to be hiring in healthcare for some time to come. We know that STEM, engineering, and the like, those have always persisted. As does business. The fields of study may shift around within business, but business degrees are steady and education degrees are steady.
But to follow up on Jerry's point, only pursue those pretty secure fields if you're interested. If you want to be an art history major, be an art history major.
That's right. The other research, which is not in this report, but other research that we do shows quite clearly that if you don't have the interests and values and personality type that's associated with a particular occupation or major, you won't do well at it. Part of the qualification for work is to be interested in the work and to share the work values.
And Anthony, I got to cut you off there. I apologize. We will be back in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the dollars and cents of different college degrees. We're looking at the economics of various fields of higher education, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. How much do you think that employment prospects, salary prospects should guide what someone chooses to study? Should it be a huge factor or somewhat of a factor? Give us a call. Tell us about your own experiences. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. With us for the hour is Anthony Carnevale, director of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, author of a new report on the economic value of different college majors, which you can find at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And joining us now from Vermont is Mariko Silver, president of Bennington College in Vermont. And President Silver, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura, and good morning, Anthony.
Hi.
Well, for those not familiar with your school, President Silver, just give us a little information. Number of students, types of degrees, areas of study that Bennington is especially known for.
Sure. So we are a small liberal arts college in Vermont, in southwest Vermont. We are a residential learning community of about 700 students, so quite small on the national scale. But that smallness gives us, I think, some major advantages. You asked about what students study here. In fact, students study an extraordinarily wide range of things. But every student has an individualized study plan, not what we'd call traditionally a major, but an individualized study plan. I heard Anthony at the tail end of the last segment talking about the need, really, for students to study what they're interested in, to study what drives them, that people learn most effectively when they're doing something that moves them. And that's what we are dedicated to here at Bennington.
And what do you know about the employment situations, President Silver, of your graduates? You know, which types of graduates are finding jobs and which aren't?
We actually do very well on that front, I think at least in part because we have something called fieldwork term. So every student every year for 7 weeks in the winter, as it happens, goes out into the world and works. The students starting freshman year, so the minute they land on campus, they actually start looking for that first job. We have an office here that helps them to do that, but they all find their own fieldwork term jobs. They interview themselves. We don't, you know, tee anything up for them. So they have to really learn the entire process. And they learn different things each year. So I've had students who, over the course of their 4 years of fieldwork terms, you know, they start out, for example, a student who graduated last year knew she was interested in psychology, and she thought she wanted to be an individual therapist. She spent a fieldwork term working with an individual therapist, decided that was not for her, still interested in psychology, spent her next fieldwork term working in a school setting, a grade school setting, thought perhaps she wanted to be a school psychologist. Turns out she doesn't like little kids all that much.
So that's good information to have
for her. Good information to have, exactly. And then she found herself by her third fieldwork term in a research setting and loved it and really found her passion, spent her next fieldwork term in a different research setting and was off to graduate school in the right thing for her.
So you find out pretty early on, while the stakes are low, right? You're not trying to, you know, cover a mortgage or something. You know, you are still in college, but you're finding out valuable information in the workforce.
That's right. And I think critical to the design in our case is that it's interwoven into the classroom experience, too. So we have something called the fieldwork term reflection essay. You don't just go out to work, come back, and then sort of flip a switch in your brain and go to class. You actually integrate that thinking and the work experience into the classroom experience. You talk about it with your advisor. You talk about it with what we call your plan committee, which is a committee of three faculty members who help you to weave together your education here. So there's a constant reflecting on the experience, not just the experience itself. I think the experience only in isolation only gets you so far. You have to understand what you've gotten out of it.
Well, and this gets to another issue, President Silver, with internships. I mean, with traditional internships, you know, done during the summer or maybe over a long Christmas break, some kids, students can't afford to take an unpaid internship over the summer. So you're kind of getting rid of that problem by making it part of the school year.
Yes, well, it certainly is also an issue. So if a student wants to go to New York City and work somewhere that's unpaid, they have to find a place to live and so on and so forth. We use our network as an institution to help them to do that, right? So we have students, for example, who, you know, one kid lives in New York, the other kid lives in Chicago. They basically swap parents for fieldwork term. So, you know, one lives in the other's house and they get to work out in the world and live for free. So we do use our network to help them to do that. We also have some grants programs in terms. Internally, for example, we had a number of students who went to the West Bank this year. We have students who have gone to Africa and Indonesia and India and on and on. And to do that, they often need help with airfare and so forth, and we do support them in that.
All right. Well, I want to go to our listeners, and then I have a question for you too, Anthony Carnevale, on this. Our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Tom's in Pembroke. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to preface my comment by saying I am not a college graduate. I actually don't even have a high school degree, but I am successful in the tech industry. And I just wanted to say, you know, I've watched a lot of my friends go to college, and I'm seeing a lot of them pay for a lot of unnecessary prerequisite courses. My girlfriend paid $1,000 to take French for, you know, basically one class, and I don't see her getting anything out of that. And I think that's really financially burdening a lot of people going to school.
Thank you very much for calling in, Tom. You know, this is a point that comes up. I'll throw this to you, I think, President Silver. You know, fine to focus on a field of study, a career, real-world learning, but what about all those pesky prerequisites that people have to pay for?
Well, so at Bennington, we actually don't have prerequisites in that way. I would say, however, maybe I'll take this as an opportunity to talk a little bit about liberal arts more generally. So we're not organized in that way where you have prerequisites and you have to take, you know, let's say a language and this and that. On the other hand, we do encourage our students to study broadly. In fact, maybe the only requirement, if you will, is that they do study both broadly and deeply. It's just that they don't have to do it in a particular way, in a particular order. Because from our point of view, what we are trying to encourage, as I heard Anthony allude to, is flexibility and adaptability, an ability to work through a problem, and not just in the way that it's presented to you in the problem set for your homework, but to really understand the relationship between the intense complexity of the real world and the tools that you're learning in the classroom.
That's the critical thinking skills that everybody talks about.
That's right. That's right. But I think that the term critical thinking sometimes doesn't, you know, it evokes a person, I think of the statue of the thinker, right? A person sitting alone on a rock contemplating life. Now, that's valuable. Don't get me wrong. But I think we don't do a good enough job, frankly, in higher ed of explaining what critical thinking means and the relationship between that and really deep problem solving. I mean, to take the tech industry, as Tom the caller mentioned, you know, it is important not just to understand the technicalities of technology and, of course, the science and the engineering, but really to also understand what humans will respond to. I mean, why do we all have Apple computers? It's because of the design, which is not pure technology, it's emotion.
So a little bit of sociology there.
Sociology or even, you know, if I could dare say it, poetry.
Well, Tom, thank you for the call. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Anthony Carnevale, here's an email from Augustus that gets to what you and I talked about earlier. You know, the focus on education just for education's sake. Here's what Augustus says. The ideal of education as an end rather than a means was born in an environment when education was available primarily to those who were already wealthy and typically to a landed gentry whose continued wealth depended upon possession of large estates managed and maintained by others. In that environment, Augustus says, the educated to afford to live the ideal of education for its own sake, but we don't live in that world anymore. Most people don't have that luxury. He says the wealth even of the American gentry, and certainly of the vast majority of people who are going to college to become educated, depends directly on their own efforts and skills, and education must be, at least partially, an investment in those skills. Augustus, thank you for the point. I really appreciate it. And I wonder what you think, Anthony Carnevale. We're trying to find the right balance here, right?
Yes, and it wasn't necessary long ago when education was for white Protestant men. There is a something changed, and what changed happened began in 1983. Before 1983, 70% of the American workforce had high school or were dropouts. A full 30 to 40% were high school dropouts. A lot of them had been in the military. They did just fine. They were virtually all middle class. And in fact, the value of college in the 1970s relative to a high school degree, the value of college was declining. But then in 1983, something happened, and it's a long story, but the short version of it is there was a switch in the American economy, and the value of college went up over high school, went from about 30% to 84%. It was a fundamental change in the American economic structure. And so, like it or not, college, some form of post-secondary education or training, not what we traditionally call college, is now necessary to join the middle class. And that reality is what's really stumping us, because we're having a hard time affording that, as well as the kind of general education you get at Bennington for all Americans.
All right, let's take another call. And Lee joins us from Concord. Hi, Lee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead, Lee.
Good. I was just calling. I have a degree in music performance from the New School in New York for jazz performance. And from that, it was really hard. It's just not a very economical viable, you know, it's not economically viable career, really, in a lot of ways, although it is a passion. And I did get into the field of education and, you know, found that a lot of music jobs are part-time or the first thing that's cut when the economy goes sour is music jobs. And so I'm back in school now in my late 30s going to NHTI for software development, and found that I love that too. I really love programming. But I just think we need to do a better job, and it sounds like people are really thinking about this, some of your people that you're interviewing today, that we need to help guide young people, because it's not just about what you're passionate about and thinking, if I just go down that path, everything will be fine. But really looking at your economic background, where you're coming from, and knowing what sort of a career and what kind of money you'll be making to provide for family in the future. Those are things that young people need to be helped with.
It's tricky, yeah. Lee, the word guide, though. It's you want to fold in some of what you're talking about, you know, that it was really tough and in the end you couldn't get a good job with that degree. On the other hand, you don't want to tell somebody you need to study computer science when they, you know, don't like working with computers.
Oh, clearly. Yes, I agree with that. Not so much maybe guide like, you know, this is a career for you, but
right.
maybe just share with people, you know, what the economic outlook is for the career that they're choosing, and that there might be other passions out there for them, too. You know, certainly if I hated computer programming, it wouldn't be a good path for me. I just happened to find in doing it that I loved it. As I looked for other career paths, I thought of the medical, maybe getting going for nursing or something, and the more I looked into that, it really wasn't for me. So it's a good point. But
well, Lee, do you regret that time in New York studying jazz music?
It was a great part of my life, and it made me part of who I am. But I think if I had more of a perspective that financially, this, even though it's a passion for me, it was going to be more of a hobby that was hard to reckon with, then I may have approached it. For instance, I got into Barnard, and I didn't go there. And I might have liked to have gone someplace like that and studied music on the side and still gone and played music. But
wow.
I didn't have put all my eggs in one basket.
Well, Lee, it's really interesting to hear from you. Thank you very much for calling and sharing this story. Really appreciate it. And it relates to an email also that I have here from Jordan in Boston, who says, a degree is worth it for landing at least some good job, and got me my job in university research finance. But, Jordan says, my BS from Plymouth State and MA from Boston University were in eco-sustainability, so I'm not doing what I wanted and trained for. Jordan says, what I really could have used to make the $140,000 in loans truly worth it would have been not only an academic advisor, but a career advisor, Jordan says, that keeps their ear to the ground, telling me how the job market really is and how to get there. So what do you think about Jordan's email and Lee's experience, Anthony Carnevale? I wonder what you pull out of these two stories.
Well, I feel strongly what is, I think, in the end, common sense, and that is that students have a right to know before they go what the career prospects are for different majors, and that that ought to be told to them very clearly, I think, in the course catalog. In fact, I would argue that we don't have enough money to pay for the counseling. We have 400 counselors per high school student now, and there are not enough in high school. We're not going to be able to build out a similar system in college. But the information is there now, so transmitting that to students either in some sort of a class in college, or I would argue a class in high school that would also include talking to them about how they're going to finance their college education, because 65% of them are going to go. This is not just for the top 10 kids anymore. So it is a huge investment. It's the biggest investment young people make that they carry on their own. The debt does forestall, we know, them forming families. Used to be that in the 70s you hit the average hourly wage in America at age 26. Basically, people started forming families at that age. Now that age is 32 and 34 for minorities in America, where you hit that family formation stage. So we've added a whole new stage to the economic life cycle, which is getting some kind of post-high school education and work experience, and we left students on their own.
Well, what do you think, President Silver, given the debt that Anthony mentions and that we certainly feel here in New Hampshire, given that we've got the highest debt loads for our college students, given the debt, do colleges have more of a responsibility these days to lay out, you know, the dollars and cents and the realities?
I do think colleges have a responsibility to provide career advising to help students to understand what the marketplace for their skills are out there, whether it's using that as an opportunity while the student is still in college to encourage them, for example, to take a calculus course or an econ course or to take a sociology course. We spend a lot of time, I think, and when I say we, I mean the broad we of higher education, helping students to understand what it means for them to advance within a discipline, because that's how the vast majority of higher education is organized. And we need to turn our angle of view a little bit more, which we've worked on doing here through fieldwork term and other mechanisms, to really help students to understand not just at the moment when they are leaving college, but all the way along the way, how the decisions they are making can impact their employment prospects. Not just whether they will get a job, although of course that's incredibly important, but in what kind of field they will get a job. To the caller emailer's point about having studied environmental studies and now working in a different area, I do think we owe it to students to have real conversations about the choices that they're making. And I think Anthony's right, it's a real challenge when you get out of, frankly, a very privileged environment like Bennington, where students can have the kind of one-on-one relationships with faculty members and the career advisors can really know them, which we can do here and many other colleges can do, but not every college can do, and is hard to do at scale. How do you have that conversation in a way that is, as you said to Lee, not overly prescriptive and not diminishing of the field of possibility, but really opens up the world to them? And one of the things that I'm always quite startled by among, let's say, first years here is what a narrow view they have often coming in of what their career possibilities are, because they only know what their parents did and what their parents' friends did or what they, you know, read about and see on television or things like that. But, you know, having those conversations along the way, which we work on very intensively here, about what the full range of work possibilities are is incredibly important, and connecting that to what they're studying is extremely valuable, and it is our obligation.
Well, and they get that sense from the field work that they have to do single year. President Silver, it's been really nice to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mariko Silver, again, president of Bennington College in Vermont. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with the founder of an organization called UnCollege, who questions the whole notion of a traditional higher education degree. And we'll take more of your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the dollars and cents of different degrees in an era of sky-high college costs. We're looking at new research from Georgetown University on the unemployment rates and salaries for college graduates in all sorts of majors. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour is Anthony Carnevale, director of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, author of the report I mentioned, which you can find at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Anthony, right back to our listeners. Stephen's waiting in Manchester. Hi, Stephen. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that I noticed, at least in as a STEM major, you don't really go to college to learn a bunch of facts and figures that you can apply to your day-to-day job. I use maybe about 20% of what I learned in college in my career. I was an aerospace engineering major. I got a job in mechanical engineering. Now I'm a process engineer. So it's very flexible, and really the concentration should be more on how to think and not just, you know, you need to take this major if you want a job in this field.
And where did you go to school, Stephen? I'm curious.
I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Wow. And it sounds like you've done really well for yourself with that STEM degree.
Yeah. And like I said, I got a job in mechanical engineering as opposed to aerospace, and this is a very aerospace-centric college. I'm using about 20% of what I learned, but that's what I need to do my job. The rest of it is really fluff.
Stephen, thank you very much for calling in. Anthony, real quick, what do you think? You know, he got a STEM degree. That's the degree that so many young people are being told to get. But he's saying, you know, it was a degree that gave me the flexibility that I needed.
One of the interesting things that's happened in the last 30 years is that STEM has become the new liberal arts, in the sense that almost any STEM major, and there are some exceptions, but almost any STEM major gives people the basic technical skills required across a broad array of jobs. So what we find is that STEM majors, they tend to work in STEM fields. If we were doing this study, we would say that this young man was not working in his field, but in a broader sense, I think he is. And that is that they have lots of STEM majors have lots of choices coming out of college across a broad array of technical fields, and then because of their technical knowledge, they move very rapidly into management, that is, or into sales or marketing or other fields, because if you're going to be selling technical product, whether it's in healthcare or engineering or aerospace, to other technical people, you better have, even if you're a salesperson, you better understand the technology. No one's going to listen to you. So STEM has become a curiosity in that regard. It's now 19%, almost 20% of college majors. But it really gives people a range, flexibility that we used to ascribe to the humanities, which still does. Humanities, people move around a lot, but at much lower wage levels and have a more difficult time getting into management.
Well, that's interesting. And I remember, you know, back in the day, 20, 30 years ago, people were told, you know, get an English degree, get a history degree, because that'll give you that sort of broad knowledge and broad flexibility.
Well, you know, interestingly, two of the anomalies, or at least anomalies that run against the stereotype, is that English degrees and American history degrees still do pay off quite well. That the general skills, the dispersion of people who get those degrees is very broad among occupations, so it's very hard to find them working in field unless they're teachers. But those two kinds of talents, when nurtured, tend to result in pretty strong employment histories.
All right. Well, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Thank you for that call. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Anthony, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us now from California, Dale Stevens, founder of UnCollege, a gap year program for young adults. And Dale Stevens, thank you very much for getting up early and joining us on the exchange.
For sure.
So what is UnCollege, Dale? Give us the elevator speech.
UnCollege is a sticky notion that there's something that is changing in higher ed. We specifically run a gap year program, but UnCollege became this meme about what the future of higher ed might look like. It's not just attached to institutions. And our message ultimately is that higher education and furthering yourself is really important, but you should be really careful about what you spend your time and money investing in. Because you don't want to wake up when you're 22, having wasted 4 years of your life, and find out that you're $30,000 in debt.
Yeah, or even more, as we've heard from some of our listeners. So it's a type of higher education, Dale, just not done in sort of the traditional Ivy halls for 4 years.
Correct. So we run a gap year program that's based on the idea that there are a bunch of skills that are really important that are taught implicitly, but we think that should be taught explicitly. So we try and teach specifically how to learn. We teach things like how do you negotiate, communicate, keep yourself motivated, evaluate yourself, give and get feedback, be self-aware. The kinds of things that you may ostensibly learn by writing lit analysis papers in English class, but no one ever explicitly says this is the reason that you're doing it.
Yeah.
More broadly, there's people who associate with us, but aren't necessarily part of our program, and we serve as a resource for them as well.
So it's a gap year program, Dale, where you come, from what I understand, you have an international experience, you have a sort of in-group experience, you come up with a project. Give us a little bit more there, if you could, what that gap year is like.
Our students spend 3 months abroad doing a service learning project. They spend 3 months residentially in San Francisco with their cohort of 15 or 20 peers, engaging in this curriculum and having a coach who works with them one-on-one to help them shape their own goals, connect to the right resources and mentors. They spend 3 months doing a coached internship and finish out the year doing a project. And the idea is that we want people to understand who they are, how they learn, and what they want to do. So that if they do go off to college, they go with an understanding of how to make the most of that time. And if they choose to go into the workforce, they have the right skill set and toolkit to keep learning over the course of their career.
How much does it cost?
The cost of the program is $1,000 for the year, which includes room and board for half the year.
And who does this work for, Dale? I'm curious what you think. Who does this work for? What kind of person? And who doesn't this work for?
We see three types of students who excel in the program. The first are explorers who have a broad idea of what they want to do with their lives. They say, I want to go into design, but they don't really know what the different actual jobs are there. And we help them parse that out, figure that out, and define a path to get there. The second are people who are founders, people who really want to start something, whether that's becoming a freelancer and working independently, or whether that's going to start an organization, large or small. And the third are people that we think of as transformers, people for whom the traditional system didn't work. They wanted something more engaging, more hands-on, more practical, and they've usually done a year or two of college, maybe even graduated, and are looking for a year to get unstuck. It doesn't work for folks who don't work hard. Being self-motivated and self-directed requires putting in a lot of hard work. And if that's not something that you want to do, that's not our.
So if you need a little more push and you're not a self-directed person, it's not going to work for you.
Correct.
So what if you came from a not-so-great school system, maybe a disadvantaged background, you didn't learn how to write properly or have a basic understanding of civics? Would you be missing something from doing this program that might catch up with you later on?
What's really interesting that we see is actually that the demographics of our students break down into people who are from the demographic that you exactly described, as well as from the demographic of people who went to really elite private prep schools. And we see almost no one in the middle, and that's because you can be a misfit if you're an underprivileged student in a bad school system who really wants to work hard and learn, but the system doesn't provide that, just as easily as you can be a misfit who is at a really good school but wants to do something more practical and wants to ask more questions.
Did you say misfit, Dale?
I did.
Yeah. What about that? I mean, is that what UnCollege is for, misfits?
Misfits within the broader sense of the word. I mean, the school is very good at educating a particular kind of person, but it's not necessarily very good at tailoring to people's specific interests or learning preferences. And we feel like we're a place for those who don't want to just sit in a lecture for 45 minutes, who want to get out and engage and really, really learn.
Yeah, as we heard from Bennington College earlier, again, getting students out there, doing things, getting their hands on. Dale Stevens, real interesting. Thank you again very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Dale Stevens, founder of UnCollege, a gap year program, as we heard, for young adults. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Anthony Carnevale, before we go back to our listeners, you know, there is more interest these days in taking a gap year, whether it's at a program like UnCollege or not. More interest, as we heard from President Silver at Bennington College, in getting your hands on a particular job, exploring things. There does seem to be more interest these days in kind of getting out of the usual chalk and talk mode of a college education.
Yes, and that's very healthy. You've had two guests here, the lady from Bennington and this gentleman, who are really struggling at the cutting edge of change in higher ed. They're trying to do something that we're just learning how to do, which is to educate the whole person. And in the end, that will work for people who can afford it, number one, and secondly, for people for whom a gap year isn't a year in which they disconnect from their own goals and developmental pathway. So what we know is that if you put off college for a year, it reduces your chances of graduating by about 20%.
Really? Now, why is that? You just get off track?
Yes, because for the most part, when you're talking about the broad population of young Americans, skipping a year allows one more year of life to happen to you, and that reduces your chances of going back. If you've got highly motivated and well-prepared and students who are backed by resources, that's crucial,
who can make many mistakes. And that's really the difference among college graduates who make it and don't, is how many mistakes do you get to make, because they're all going to make them. They're young. That's their right. So if you're well-funded and well-motivated, gap years and programs of the sort we've heard about in and out of college are really terrific. But for the general population, they're sort of dangerous.
Really? Now, that's interesting, because so many people speak so highly of the gap year. You know, I was focused. I was able to not waste time floundering about. I came to college kind of knowing what I wanted to do, and instead of just wasting time bouncing from major to major or whatever.
So yes, and that's the case. If you are well-motivated and well-funded, and you can make mistakes and experiment and still come back, this is terrific. But it's at the high end of the education system where this works. If you're not clear about where you're going, what you want to do, and most students are simply lost when they walk through the door. Most of them don't ever get talked to or touched by a professional, really. They just go to class. Teachers don't talk to them much. We've got a system where young people are pretty much disconnected. In places like Bennington and programs of the sort we just heard about, they're very connected. That's the difference. So you got to be sure that when your son or daughter comes to you and says, well, I think I'm going to take a year off, that they're not going to lay on the couch and watch TV.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is Ross in Madbury. Hey, Ross. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hey, no problem. I wish I'd called earlier so I could hear you hash this one out. But I am calling specifically about why colleges and universities cost so much. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's an inequitable relationship between the lender and the lendee. So the lenders will give $100,000 to a student because there's no really recourse for that student. Currently, right now, for instance, if you file for bankruptcy or something like that, those loans are protected. So you have to become severely disabled or otherwise to get out of that debt. So I wonder if how things would change if that piece changed. I bet that students wouldn't be able to get those loans and colleges would have to decrease the cost of the education.
Yeah, and Ross, thank you for calling. And boy, Anthony, we've done, you know, dozens of shows on this program about why college costs so much. That's a little outside the purview of your research, but I do wonder what you think. The fairness of a system where, you know, you got to get that college degree. Your research clearly shows if you don't get it, you won't do as well. But if you can't afford it, then you can't afford it. It's unfair.
The reality of college in America today is that it is worth it. I mean, there are cases when it's not, of course. Maybe 20% of degrees end up paying high school wages. But, you know, an 80% success rate for a bachelor's degree or graduate degree, really pretty good. I mean, in baseball, that's an 800 batting average, and even Ted Williams couldn't do that. So, but the bottom line is it costs too much, not because it inherently costs too much. It's because we can't afford it. So college is worth it, but we can't afford it. So this is the dilemma we face, and that is more and more public investment is going into, or public money is going into retirement for the elderly, and we're disinvesting in the young. States and the federal government are not paying for this. And truthfully, it's an industry. It's sort of like a big computer with no operating machine, no operating system. It's a $490 billion industry, and it doesn't run on any kind of outcome standard. There's no metrics for quality, or we don't track earnings from graduates by program, cost, time to graduation. There is a rebellion against that among the political class who are going to start to institute these standards, from legislatures, governors, and presidents, and that's what's coming. But the cost issue is very profound. In part, it's because college, like healthcare, is a service, and it's hard to get efficiency in services, although we're doing it in healthcare. And we've done it. The most highly productive industries in America now are service industries, like finance and information and so on and so forth. And the computer has a lot to do with this. So we're at the very front end of trying to figure out how to deliver college with higher quality and lower costs. But we're down that road now.
Well, Ross, I really appreciate the call. And I'll share this Facebook comment from Zachary, who says, as an undergrad, I can say that future salaries are not my main reason for choosing my major. No matter what I choose to do, UNH will keep me buried in debt for the next three decades of my life. Zachary, thank you for the Facebook comment. Good luck to you. Anthony Carnevale, you know, talking about the data, you've got the data in this report. So again, we'll direct folks to it on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And thanks for being with us, Anthony. We appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Anthony Carnevale, director of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, author of a new report on the economic value of different college degrees. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.